You're listening to WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. Welcome to Connecting the Notes. I'm your host, Matthew Ray, and tonight on the show, we'll be featuring the music of Mike Silverman, better known as That One Guy. He performs as a one-man band playing a homemade instrument he calls the Magic Pipe. He's currently on the road and was kind enough to take time to talk to us earlier today, so coming up this hour, we'll have plenty of his music as well as excerpts from our interview. If you like what you hear, he'll be playing Thursday evening at the Iron Horse at 10 p.m. We'll be right back. That was That One Guy with The Moon Is Disgusting. He's currently on tour and was kind enough to talk to me earlier today. Here's the first portion of our interview.
So I won't ask you to describe your music, since that's pretty difficult, but would you like you to explain the instrument, the magic pipe you use to create these sounds?
Yeah, it's made of aluminum pipes and triggers, and it's very much a string-based instrument. It's got two strings on it, a low bass string and a high melody string, and sort of allows me to be a one-man orchestra.
Can you explain those sensors that are on the top? I think one of my friends swore they were arcade buttons. What do those do?
They're basically our buttons. They're fed into a sampler, and I can basically trigger sounds with them. And their sounds can be anything. The sampler itself is an old SP-808, and I basically sample me banging on trash cans and breaking light bulbs and hitting trees and all kinds of stuff, and basically the sounds can be anything I dream of.
What about the, you also use something called a magic boot?
Yeah, it's an electric cowboy boot. I've wired up the sole to be a sort of an electric hand drum, and then I plug into the heel, and I sort of play it like an African talking drum in a way. It kind of changes pitches and modulates using some of the effects that I have wired into it, and it's basically like an acoustic electric hand drum. That's the best way to describe what it really is.
And did you conceive that idea at the same time you conceived the magic pipe itself, or did it come later?
It came later. The boot came kind of last. It's probably the most recent thing I've done in terms of inventing an instrument.
And when did you come up with the idea for the magic pipe?
The idea started back in the mid-90s, just as sort of a rough concept. I didn't do anything about it until the end of the 90s. Just around 99 is when I built the thing. I started working on the idea and finishing the idea in my mind, and then it took a couple months and just started building.
So, you constructed it yourself?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that your first attempt, or is that something you've been trying to do for a while?
No, it was my first attempt, and I had never built an instrument prior to that.
Wow. Did you ever look into possibly getting it done by someone else, or?
Yeah, that was the first thing I did. I went to a guitar builder who built these really interesting, different kind of looking guitars, and he thought, yeah, we can build something for $10,000, and I remember thinking, I'm not even sure if this is going to work, or I'm even going to like playing it, so I better try this myself first and just see, you know, how it shapes up. And it turned out to be such the right move, because it really kind of, the function, because only I was the only one that kind of understood what I was trying to do, because it was an abstract concept in my mind. And so by me just kind of digging into it and going for it, it kind of built itself in a much more sort of true fashion than I think someone else could have built it for me. And it really did. It kind of came right out of my subconscious and sort of took shape.
Weezer pot pie, dig a little ditch and hold the phones. Weezer pot pie, fill it all in with butterfly bones. Weezer pot pie, scribble on days and dribble on drones. Weezer pot pie, and pick your teeth with the butterfly bones. Weasel pot pie, pick a little bitch, then sing alone. Weasel pot pie, then poke him in the stitches till they grimace and moan. Weasel pot pie, bigger than bricks and sticks and stones. Weasel
you started out as a bass player, so you're classically trained. When did you start playing?
I started playing when I was 10 years old. My dad was a professional jazz bass player, and so I had an upright bass in the house when I was a kid, which is a pretty lucky break. And basically, it just kind of evolved from there. You know, I was I studied music in school and started playing jazz for a living, and became sort of a professional bass player myself, playing all different styles, you know, from rock to punk to jazz to funk and all kinds of world music and stuff. There's a real vibrant scene in the Bay Area and California, where I'm from, in the mid to late 90s. I was a part of it. I kept working constantly when I was younger, and that sort of like kind of laid the foundation for everything I'm doing now. I mean, everything I'm doing now is a mix of all these styles and things.
Were you ever in any bands, or were you purely like a session player during those times?
I was in both. I mean, I had my own band that was sort of my main focus. It was called the Fabulous Hedgehogs. I played bass and sang and was sort of the main songwriter in that thing. Me and the guitar player wrote all the music together, and I did all the lyrics, and that was sort of my creative outlet. Then I was this real sort of side man for hire guy most of the time. And, you know, I did that for a living for quite a while. I was playing 8-9 gigs a week doing this stuff and then getting in the Hedgehogs where I could. And we made albums and toured a little bit. Mostly, everything we did and everything I did was local, because the Bay Area scene was so insular and it was just really kind of happening. And it was really, really a fun little scene to be a part of. And I used all this stuff to sort of, to get it all together.
Have you ever played the Magic Pipe? I mean, I know you toured with Buckethead, and I saw you play on stage with him. Other than that, did you ever break that out while you were touring around with other musicians, or?
Not too often. I used band drums and tuba a lot. They were good friends of mine. We toured three tours together, and we did some collaborating where I played with them, and the thing with Buckethead, and then not too often though. I think it's such a weird instrument to try to fit in with other people. It's, you know, it's such a big presence, that thing, and so basically it's more conducive for what I'm doing by myself.
How did the work with Buckethead come about?
We played some gigs together about 3 years ago, and just kind of hit it off in terms of musically and stuff, and it just seemed to make sense. You know, there's some weird overlap with our music, even though what we do is so different. But he's so amazingly creative, and, you know, together we seem to make a pretty neat team and sort of bring different musical elements out of each other. And for some reason, the Magic Pipe seems to work really well with him. It doesn't always work with other people too well. But with him, it's like I can kind of function as a rhythm section a little bit and kind of fill up a lot of sound, which is really fun.
That was Buckethead with Clones. You're listening to Connecting the Notes tonight. We're featuring that one guy who shared the stage with Buckethead. That one guy talked to us earlier today, and here's more from our interview.
I saw your name credited for the Tom Waits Orphans album, but wasn't very specific. That's quite an accomplishment. How'd you get that together?
Well, yeah, that was an interesting one. I got called to actually play Saw, Bode Saw, which is something I've been doing for a while on the Tom Waits album. They were looking for a Saw player, and they called me. And I've been a huge fan for a long time. I always wanted to play bass with them. And you know, I told him about the Magic Pipe when he called, and I was he sounded really excited about it. And I was going to bring it in with the Saw. And then the day before the session, he changed his mind. He wanted me to play bass, which was pretty ironic because I hadn't touched my bass in 5 years. And it turned out to be great. It was just fun to be in the studio with them, and I got to track a tune with them, you know, standing right next to him, watching his left hand for the chords, and then, like, you know, I watched him cut a vocal track, which was super inspiring, and that's actually where I reconnected with Carl Dorfler, who's the engineer who did my last album. He was doing this album with Tom Waits' record, and I was watching them work together, and you know, things were coming together so quick, and I was sort of in a rut with my own recording, and I thought, wow, this is the guy to use, so that's how I reconnected with Carl. But yeah, that was just, it was a pretty incredible summer, doing all those, getting to do that project, and then getting to finish my own album, too.
What track were you on that album?
On there's two I did on the ballad CD. There's a track called Widow's Grove, and you can hear the bass pretty well. That's the one we tracked live. And then I did an overdub on that tune Lowdown on the Brawlers.
Oh yeah, okay.
But it's bass is mixed pretty low on that track. You can barely hear it, but you can hear it really well. The fun was on the ballad, so it was cool. It was two tracks. It was basically two songs.
Roar you in the dust, held your hand to the heavens, pulled your heart to the earth. There was something that blinded me more than the mist and the breath of the cottonwoods, but not yet. And you rode the maypole of dance hall legs, galloped to another's embrace, and I bit the flowers from your wrist corsage. You waltzed too slowly waltz with that girl from Widow's Grove. Oh, I followed you to the river that washes to the sea, through the wind, through the rain of a cold, dark night. That's where I'll be. Near the breath of a swallow, the petals dropped as you fell, and you grabbed and shyly held me against the stone cool well. In your hand was a glass, you held the ice against the night, and it dripped and it sparkled, and I laughed a wish. Before it all slipped down the dark tunnel well, I heard it melt quietly, and I looked at it. Just one pleading wish, your skirts brushed to the furious bounding. Oh, I follow you to the river that washes out to the sea, through the wind, through the rain of a cold, dark night. That's where I'll be. hung even with your neck. And I chased you and drowned you there deep in the well. And when your mouth was full and wet, I swallowed all your reckless fate. And with your last breath, you moaned too drunk to wake. Oh, I'd follow you to the river that washes out to the sea. Through the wind, through the rain of a cold, dark night, that's where I'll be. Through the wind, through the rain of a cold, dark night, that's where I'll be.
And you mentioned Carl Derfler. He was what, an engineer, a producer with you for The Moon Is Disgusting?
Yeah, he engineered it and kind of co-produced it with me. I mean, he's a really heavyweight engineer. He just done a ton of stuff. And I'd worked with him about 10 years prior when I was doing all of my session bass playing. That's how he knew me, and that's how he knew I played Zod. And that's how I kind of got the call for the recording session with Tom Waits. So, yeah, it was all sort of a very kind of lucky, organic little process that happened that I kind of fell into.
And so that was your second album, Moon Is Disgusting. Your first one was Songs in the Key of Biatch. How did the two differ as far as the whole process of recording them?
Pretty different. The first album, I actually recorded it by myself in a little rented studio space, and I brought down all my own gear. I brought down a bunch of ADATs and my mixing board. I did it real old school, totally alone. I mixed it, mastered it, everything. It took me about a year. And that's why the way I started trying to do my second album, and I was just having a lot of trouble because my music had, I've been touring so much since the Songs in the Key of Biatch came out that my music had gotten a lot more complex, and it was taking a lot more sort of mental energy to play. And in the studio, I just couldn't split my energy between trying to be an engineer and a musician. And, you know, I was trying anyway, and I just wasn't happy with the results. And then when I met Carl, or reconnected with Carl, rather, I thought, wow, you know, I would love to just be able to play, and that's, you know, he's such a better engineer than I'll ever be, you know, and so I could just set up and play my songs, and he just recorded it, and it came together. I mean, I've been hammering it out for about a year off and trying to finish it. I could never do it, and I went in with him, and he knocked everything out in about 2 weeks because he's so quick, and I had the stuff so together already, and, you know, musically speaking, I just went in there and played and sang, and the album's kind of finished itself, so it was a totally different process. You know, I couldn't say that one's better than the other because I do like spending lots of time with something. When I spent all that time on the first record, I think that I really got into some really nice detail, which I do really like and I think is very important. Well, with the new one, it was like I got into lots of detail, but it was sort of on a different level because it was working so quickly. And a lot of the detail was in the pre-production, which is to say, me practicing, you know, which I've been doing a lot. I played all those songs live a bunch, so I had worked out a lot of detail in the arrangements sort of at the gigs, and it was basically me just going in there and just kind of hammering it out.
Had, Carl Derfler, his name kind of holds a lot of weight. Who else has he worked with in the past?
Let's see, did the Tom Waits record. He's had a pretty long history. I mean, he did stuff with Led Zeppelin back in the 70s. He did, in the 90s, he did a lot of pop records. He did, like, a couple of No Doubt records, and he worked on the Dave Matthews album, and then he's worked with Daniel Johnson, and he worked with Rocky Erickson, and it's pretty intense. I mean, his resume is pretty insane. You know, he's, like, kind of worked with pretty much everybody, and he's been making records for, you know, for like 35 years or so, and he's been in the Bay Area the whole time, but he travels all over the world, and he's one of those engineers for hire that does quite a lot. He's very accomplished.
And you met him through the Tom Waits sessions or through your Bay Area connections in the late
90s? Bay Area connections. I had done some stuff. There's this group that I used to work with called the Billy Nair Show. That was a real sort of San Francisco institution, and we had done some stuff together with Carl back in like 95, when I first met Carl, and so that's how I initially met him. And he still works with the Billionaire, so they're still making really incredible records and movies and stuff. These guys are super creative guys, and Carl just sort of knew that I did all these things. You know, he knew I did my one man band. He knew I played saw, and so I think when the need for a saw player came up, my name was given for him. So I kind of walked out on that front.
You think you'd work with him again on an upcoming album? Is there any plans in the works for?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm going to use him again. I really liked our creative sort of team that we had going, and I like the way he's so fast with things. And so, yeah, I plan on working with him again. I'm hoping this summer to do some more recording. I got a ton of material that I need to hash through on my own first, but once I do that, I think we're going to team up and make it happen for sure.
And that material you have, do you start out? I imagine you start out writing the songs. I love your lyrics, and they're kind of like a Dr. Seussian. They're fun. I really like them. But do you fit those into the music after? I know different artists go through writing songs different ways. What's your process like?
It's weird because it sort of all happens at once for me. I mean, I'm always kind of writing lyrics. I'm always kind of writing music, and basically, it's. You know, I think of the voice and I think of the words as sort of another part of the instrument, as sort of another texture. And, you know, when I'm improvising on the instrument, I just kind of play around with rhythm and improvise until I sort of stumble on something that kind of catches my ear or makes me react on some level, and then I kind of react to that idea and sort of push it all forward and sort of develop the idea a little bit. Lyrically, it's kind of the same way. I just kind of stumble on a little phrase or a kind of an idea that I just kind of inspires me or makes me laugh or something, and then I just kind of expand on that. And a lot of times, a rhythm or something that I'll play will inspire sort of a word or a phrase that kind of fits in there rhythmically, and that'll be the touchstone for the rest of the lyric. And the rest of the lyrics to the song, and then vice versa too. So there's been a couple of the songs where I've written the lyrics totally independently, and they sort of stand on their own as sort of a little folk song, and then I can write a groove or you know, I can kind of fit them in a lot of different ways. I do that a lot at the gigs. Sometimes I'll mix up lyrics with different rhythms and things, and that's what's so fun about being a one-man band is I can improvise like that and kind of change it up and do things differently. And some of my songs that I'd written for the Hedgehogs, I've even used improvisations and experiments.
That was Mike Silverman talking, aka That One Guy, the one-man band here on Connecting the Notes. We're spending the whole hour on him. Here's one of his songs, Guava. We got more from That One Guy coming up.
Hoping yes, but hearing no. Guava.
percent, but just one favor. Then we noticed the hot and funny flavor.
And the moon is disgusting. Is there? It seems like there's kind of a common theme. I mean, has the moon being made of cheese? Is that kind of like a visual fantasy of yours that's been kicking around for a while?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, I have a whole story that I'd written, like a little movie script that I've been working on for a while. That's sort of based on that whole folk tale. I mean, it's an old folk tale, the old moon being made of cheese, and this is sort of my take on it. And the album initially was going to be a soundtrack to that, and it's just it ended up just being sort of a standalone project because I didn't really have the movie thing totally together. And the album was, you know, I had all this material that I'd written that was sort of ready to roll. And so, it was kind of it does have a strong theme for sure.
And I'm guessing a lot of that material is what you're playing on the tour right now. When did the tour start, and how's it been going for you?
The tour started in 2001. It's been going great.
2001.
That's sort of a joke, but that's actually the truth. I mean, I haven't stopped touring since. I release songs in the key of yachts, and I've just been on the road pretty much the whole time since. And I've had little breaks, but I'm on the road about 11 months out of the year, so it's always this constant tour. It's been going really good. This last year and a half has been really building and getting real solid for me.
Yeah, man. You're coming from the Bay Area, and it's getting a little warmer out here. It's been an ugly week, man. You're in New York right now?
I'm in Buffalo, and it's actually beautiful out, although it was super rainy and disgusting yesterday. And actually, the last 3 or 4 days have been pretty rainy and terrible, but at least it had been warmer. I mean, we had hit some serious cold weather when I was up in Fargo and Minnesota, I drove up to Winnipeg and it was like 20 below.
Yeah. Well, that's good then. So if it's sunny there, man, maybe we'll probably follow you up here tomorrow night for the show.
I hope so.
That's a good sign.
I'm counting on it. Yeah.
Not to be so mean. What we discussed was so disgusting. Filling it up and busting at the seams. Putting the peas up with the pies. Everybody combusted but the mud machine.
Crack like a bell, but don't mean that it rings. And just cause it's shiny, don't mean that it's clean. The movement is over, the flush has begun. And just cause it's ugly, don't mean it's no fun. And just because we can, it don't mean that we should. And just cause it's modern, don't mean it smells good. Function over form, fiction over pain. And just because it's crime.
triple the babble to tell me what they say. Jingle the bell, head up and heck well, oh, the funny one kinda knows their way. I'm putting the peas out with the pies, everybody combusting, but the money it seems. End of the day, it's so abrupt, everybody corrupted, but the mud machine.
Mud machine, mud machine, I said mud machine, mud machine.
One guy with Butt Machine. That one guy is Mike Silverman's one-man band, which consists of him on a homemade bass instrument he calls the Magic Stick. He'll be playing tomorrow night at the Iron Horse, and earlier today he talked with the show about his influences.
Oh, is it influences?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Let's see. Big Captain Beefheart fan.
Nice.
That's probably no surprise. I just, lyrically, like when I sort of discovered him later when I was in college, and just lyrically, I'd already been writing sort of that freeform style for myself, and he was the first one I'd heard do it that had been doing it way, way before me, that I made me sort of realize that it was okay to do that, you know, lyrically. And then musically, I just such an amazing sort of stream of conscious sort of writing and performing the way the music comes out of him. I'm a big Zappa fan. I've been a Zappa fan for a long time, and then Rush is like my favorite band of all time, for sure. You know, I've been a huge fan of them since I was in fourth grade, and I still I see them every chance I get. They're probably my favorite band ever. And then as a jazz bass player, that music had this very deep sort of profound impact on my life, and like Miles Davis, like the early and mid Miles Davis, and then the 70s and the 80s stuff too. I got way into that weird tweaky stuff, and the John Coltrane, you know, the early stuff and the later stuff. Lately, especially the later stuff, I've been way into that, and just the sort of connecting stuff, the real sort of free, really intense music that he did sort of later in his life. I really had a big impact on me. And then what else? Ornette Coleman, that's a huge one for me. And Dewey Redmond, who I got to play with when I was bass player, he's one of my heroes for sure. And Buddy Collette and Charles Mingus, and you know, that whole world is a big part of my vocabulary. But then, you know, world music and stuff, I'm super into Brazilian music and African rhythms and African music and East, you know, Indian classical and Middle Eastern music too. You know, I kind of have a lot of that in my vocabulary, with the bow and the way I play the string. I do a lot of sort of microtonal stuff on the string because I can, because I'm not playing with anybody else, and I don't have to be in tune with anybody else, so I can really kind of find my own little keys and my own little scales and things, which I do a lot of. What else? Early 80s punk rock, I mean, that's sort of stuff I grew up with, like the early Black Flag and the Minutemen, like Mike Watts, a big influence on me. That first Firehose record and Parliament Funkadelic, Bootsy Collins is a real, really huge one. I got to meet him last year, which was pretty big moment for me. He watched me play and liked it, which was probably the biggest compliment I've ever gotten in my life.
I've been looking for an excuse to play Beefheart on this show too, so I'll definitely throw some of that in there.
Oh yeah.
You have any favorite tracks you want to hear?
Oh, Beefheart, let's see. I mean, you know, anything off of Trout Mask. I mean, Moonlight on Vermont is good, but you know, like probably my favorite record is Clear Spot.
Yeah.
And let me see, what's a good one off that
one?
Is
that got Blabber and Smoke on it?
Yeah, that's actually, I think that's Spotlight Kid.
Okay.
Which is like kind of the same record. They released them both on that one album, which is also a good record, but Clear Spot, you know, that Ted Templeton produced that. You know, he was like, you know, Van Halen and the Doobie Brothers, and that was like the first time they, I guess the label was trying to make D-Fart like a pop star, you know? And so they had Ted Templeton like really produce this record, and it came out so good. It's like, it doesn't sound dumbed down at all. It's like, if anything, it sounds more intense and sharper and like bigger, and like it really sounds good. Like the grooves are total classic D-Fart, but they're really big and fat and like almost more danceable or something. And I think the tune Clear Spot's really cool. I really love that jam a lot. And then what's that one? Big Eyed Beats of Venus too. That's like a classic, like amazing jam.
You know, a day goes by in a cardboard cutout sundown. The moon pops up like a gallery duck, sipped up gold from the sunny cup. And Longhorn saw the buggy grass, and the cowboy blew a harp sitting on his chapped ass. And the prairie flowers didn't look a bit queer, and the stars struck the sand, cartwheeled and poked in the prairie. A cactus juice stand, the only place the crows couldn't land. The bluebottle flies were as big as the cowboy's eyes, and their buzz was as loud as rattlers. A fire engine red whistle blows raspberries in a cloud of whipped steam. A tumbleweed ran out like patent yarn stink bug. Hoops from above a living male driving dot in perfect sympathy with the cardboard cutout sundown. You hardly know a day goes by in the cardboard cutout sundown.
Do you use loops while you're playing live?
You know, I do a bit of that. I don't do as much as I used to. I'm trying to play as much live as I can right now. When I first started doing my solo act, before I'd even built the pipe, there were sort of two versions of my solo act. The first was this one-string electric bass with this drum machine, and it was very minimal and weird and tons of effects and very song-oriented. And then the other version was this total free improv stuff that I was doing with my upright bass. And I was doing tons of looping with that. I was, you know, it was me and a looping machine and all these effects and just total improvisations. And it was really fun and really out there. And the Magic Pipe was kind of a combination of these two sounds, or these two concepts of that one guy. And the interesting thing is I've really gotten away from the looping because I've gotten so into playing the drums with my feet. And I find that the looping, I do a little bit of it for flavor for certain things, but what it does for me is it kind of takes me out of the moment a little bit. If I get too involved in the looping, I kind of make these big loops, and next thing I know, I'm playing with something that I've just done, but it still feels like it's in the past. You know, it's really a weird feeling. I can't describe it. Whereas when I'm playing in the moment, I really like staying in the present and kind of really pushing it that way. And so I'm getting away from the looping a bit.
Yeah, because I know when I mention you to friends, and you know, I can't explain your music nearly as well as you just have these past, you know, 20 minutes or so. But sure. People are always like, you know, they're like, oh, so he's like Keller. And I go, well, not really. I mean, Keller's a great musician, but what he does is, you know, he samples 8-9 instruments and runs around stage. And so what you're doing is more, you know, more pure, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely more live, you know, I feel, than the sort of classic looping one-man band thing like Keller or some of these other cats, you know. I mean, I like what he does. It's just a totally different trip, I think. And, you know, I just toured with this really incredible beatboxer. This guy from Minneapolis named Heatbox, who does that too. He loops and his beatboxing and then solos and does all this incredible stuff. I mean, it's totally mesmerizing. It's just a totally different trip, you know. Like, what I'm doing, I describe it more as almost juggling. I'm sort of, because I have all these samples and things and these sounds on these pads, and they're mostly one-shots, and so I'm kind of playing them in rhythm, letting them all sort of play themselves out, and it's almost like they're all giving me extra hands, so it's all live, but juggling these sort of things, these little sounds that I've captured, you know, with my sampler.
Alright, well, Mike, thank you again for taking the time, man. You're my first interview on this show. I've been doing it for, you know, 4 or 5 months, so I'm pumped to work this in finally.
Oh no, it's my pleasure, man. It's nice talking to you.
That one guy with bananas, we'd like to thank him once again for joining us and being kind enough to take his time to talk with us. You've been listening to Connecting the Notes. That one guy we featured tonight, he'll be playing tomorrow night at the Iron Horse, 10 o'clock. It'll be a good show. You should really try and make it. Next week, I'm going to be on a little bit of vacation. We'll come back at you after that with a Graham Parsons show. Please stay tuned for Poison Ivy of the Mind. Good night.